Okay, today we're going to be reviewing political opinions, political beliefs, and behaviors. We know it in both COPO and AP Gov as political culture. So every country has a political culture. An easy definition for political culture is that it's a widely shared belief system. There are values, norms, and in political culture, that's concerning the ways that politics and economics are carried on. So the political culture really defines a relationship between citizens to their government and to the economy. And if you have a good understanding of a country's political culture, it'll help you make sense of the way a country's government is set up, as well as how the decisions are made. We've talked about the two types of political cultures. Conflictual political culture is typically where you have different groups or subcultures that are clashing with opposing beliefs, and a consensual political culture has much less conflict. However, any culture has some values that are going to overlap and some that conflict. We've certainly seen that in the United States, but generally American political culture is consensual. Now, an early observer of political culture was Alexis de Tocqueville. He was the Frenchman who came to observe American democracy in the 1830s. And he wrote Democracy in America and looked at it's really considered a classic study of the American political values. So he saw that there were several things that really helped shape democracy in the United States. One, that we had a lot of resources, abundant and fertile land, that there were lots of opportunities for people to make a living, that there was no federal aristocracy, and that there was a very strong independent spirit. Now, the shared values of the American political culture are really grounded in Enlightenment philosophy, and those, of course, heavily influenced the Founding Fathers. So you have these in your notes, but I'll just review them very quickly, and then you can go back and look at them. The core values that have shaped American political culture include liberty. Think of Thomas Jefferson saying, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Equality, individualism, democracy, and rule of law. Rule of law is the belief that the government is based on a body of law that's applied equally, impartially, justly, and that's central to American political culture. Now, there have been several studies that seem to show that the United States, or Americans by comparison to the rest of the world, tend to be a little bit more nationalistic and optimistic, maybe even idealistic than people in other countries, and that kind of fits with those values. Now, regardless of those Enlightenment values, there are two other things that help define almost the changes in American values, and those are capitalism and free enterprise. So that could be at times in conflict with the old value of equality. That's going to create some tensions. Think of U.S. history. You have robber barons that were accused of exploiting workers and limiting competition in order to try and get ahead of themselves, but, you know, kind of take away other people's liberties as well. The other belief that has been kind of added to our political culture is that government responsibility for general welfare. That's going to lead to several of the social welfare policies like Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and unemployment compensation. Although the preamble to the Constitution states that promotion of the general welfare is a major purpose of our government, that meaning was transformed once again during the Great Depression in the 1930s. In Roosevelt's 1944 inaugural address, he outlined a second Bill of Rights that talked about a very firm commitment to economic security and independence. And we've seen the increasing role of the government responsibility. There's been lots of debates on the merit of government-sponsored plans, and in modern day we've got the Healthcare Reform Act, Obamacare, which is a good example of that. Now, democracy comes oftentimes with some degree of political tolerance. However, we find that anything related to political tolerance tends to be much more complex. So Americans agree that we should have free speech and religion and the right to petition to an extent, and most people are not as politically tolerant as they proclaim themselves to be. But we do allow people that we disagree with to do a lot of things politically. The other big term that comes out of this introduction to political culture is the concept of political efficacy. And this really relates down to the belief that you matter to your government, that you believe that the government will respond to your personal needs or your beliefs. And a lot of Americans believe that the government's too big or too pervasive to truly be sensitive to individual needs. But Americans tend to feel a slightly higher degree of political efficacy than many other people around the world. And that has a lot to do with the fact that we're willing to, you know, get involved, sign petitions, solve community problems, and even talk about politics. Now, this is going to feed right into the next topic, which is public opinion. Public opinion is the distribution of individual attitudes towards a political issue, candidate, or institution. Now, and that may sound like a very simple definition, but anytime you're trying to measure political opinion, you're taking into account a lot of different people's thoughts. And so public opinion and opinion polling has become an integral part of the political process. In class, we discussed the very complex process of collecting political opinion and public opinion. You've got polls. You've got a candidate running that wants to know how they're doing, so they might run a poll to see what the approval rate is. Then there are, in your textbook, there are several items that are discussed to help create accurate polling. The first one is that you've got to have a representative sample. So you want to try and get people who are representative of the entire population. And the most common technique employed is random sampling. So that is supposed to give everyone an equal probability of being selected. The Gallup poll is one of the most prestigious, and even their sample poll tends to be on random digit dialing, where they just dial random phone numbers. Now with the internet, we're also seeing differences in how information is collected. However, anytime you give a poll, there's an expectation that respondents are going to have some knowledge of the issues. So people who say, I don't know, or I haven't thought about it much, kind of show that there's a lack of political knowledge. Questions on any type of poll or survey need to be worded very carefully and objectively. You can't have loaded questions using, you know, emotional words or asking how much do you dislike the President of the United States, because any answer you give will skew the results. A straw poll, you'll see sometimes on TV. This is when you basically ask people to just call in and give your opinion. It's not very accurate, but it's very cost efficient. It's cheap. So a lot of polls will have budgets. The larger the poll, the more it's going to cost. And you have to be careful of a sampling error. Typically a margin of plus or minus 3 is considered okay. That's a typical error. But that still means that 95% of the time the poll results are going to be within plus or minus 3%. Now, political socialization and any other factors that affect political attitudes all contribute to our political culture. But a lot of this will speak to how Americans, U.S. citizens, are willing to participate. So lots of different factors. The most important form of political socialization comes from your family. That is tends to play a huge role in shaping your political attitudes, but also your initial party identification. And polls show that most young people will identify with their political parties, at least initially. A second influence is gender. So a person's gender can influence their political views. More women consider some issues more serious than some men do. Men tend to support military actions, for example. Women tend to consider comparable pay more important. And even though we've seen some shifts in the political parties, when women first were likely to vote, they were actually more likely to support the Republican Party in the 1920s, but that changed until in the 1960s, and that correlation reversed, and women were supporting the Democrats, and men tend to support the Republicans. Now, those are very very big generalizations, so you know that people are going to be on multiple sides of the political party or political ideology debate, and yet there are still some generalizations that do apply. Religion can determine your political attitude. There are some specifics that are mentioned. Catholics tend to be more liberal on economic issues than they are on social issues. Protestants tend to be more conservative on economic matters. There are lots of different kind of general breakdowns of those. Education, how your level of education can also impact your political attitude, but sometimes those are conflicting results. But at least the stereotype is that the more education you have, the more likely you are to be liberal. I don't know. And then social class, this is a socioeconomic status. You'll see some divisions. Low to middle income tend to be more supportive of the Democratic Party. High top incomes tend to be more supportive of the Republican Party. Race and ethnicity. There's been a little less research in this area, but we can track it in presidential elections. We know that most African Americans, that's like 90%, will vote for the Democrats in a presidential race. And geographic region, if you can get an image of the Electoral College map, excuse me, from the last election in 2012, you know that people on the East Coast tend to be, people on the coasts tend to be more liberal than right in the middle of the country. There are still pockets of conservatism in every state. However, the way that it typically breaks down is a great divide between the states, so that red middle part of the United States. Quick review of the different political ideologies. And when we talk now about ideology, and hopefully you can see how these terms kind of feed together, political culture is based on the political socialization of the people that have created a political ideology. The easy one is to look at the two liberals and conservative camps, but there are several in between. Reactionary on the far right, radical on the far left, with moderates or centrists right in the middle of this political spectrum. So people have a trend that they will sometimes go with certain issues. We found that the linear spectrum is no longer really relevant because people don't tend to fit on a line. So the terms liberal and conservative are meaningful for political activists, but to the voter, most of us don't fit so nice and neatly into that box. There are some key differences on issues. Healthcare, liberals say that healthcare should be more widely available. Conservatives say healthcare should be handled privately. Taxes, liberals think there should be more redistribution of income. Conservatives think that taxes should be kept very low. Welfare state, military spending, crime, you'll see differences in those ideologies. Okay. Finally, the last part of this section is going to be political participation and voter behavior. We've talked about the types of participation. You should know the ways that people participate. Protest, contacting politicians, voting. We've looked at or review the demographics on who is likely to participate. A lot of this falls down the same lines as we discussed with political culture. Education, religious involvement, race and ethnicity, age, gender tend to have voting trends. It's important to note that an individual is affected by these factors: age, social class, education level, race, gender, party affiliation. And so some of those factors form cross-cutting cleavages, making it very important to control for other factors. So, for example, if you wanted to compare gender differences in voting rates, then you might have to compare men and women of similar ages, education level, race and party affiliation. Otherwise, that voting behavior may be caused by a factor other than just gender. Voting is, however, at the heart of a modern democracy. It sends a message to the government about what the people want. And while our voting rights have expanded in the United States, really excluding very few people, only about 50% of the eligible voters will vote in a presidential election. So you should review the expanding suffrage, the changes in suffrage in American history, removing the property restrictions, granting suffrage for Black Americans and former slaves. That was the 15th Amendment. And even though, despite the amendment, many states passed Jim Crow laws, literacy tests, poll tests, it was still in the Constitution. Women's suffrage, 19th Amendment, and that was in 1920. And then the final expansion in 1971 with the 26th Amendment was 18 to 21-year-olds with the right to vote. There's a difference between eligible voters and those that actually show up. There's also a lot of difference in voter registration between the states. One of note, something you should have in the back of your head, is the Motor Voter Bill. This was the 1993 National Voter Registration Act that allowed people to apply to vote while they were renewing their driver's license, and that increased the number of registered voters significantly. Although people will cite several reasons for why there's low voter turnouts, that it's hard to vote absentee, that there's too many people on the ballot, that it's an inconvenient day to vote, that even our political parties can't really rally us to vote. Okay, that was a very quick overview of everything related to political culture, and hopefully it sparked some memories of terms and generalizations that you should know. Next will be political parties.